against us in those kind of numbers. The attack on Minden Hall was nearly 200 strong, and those were defeated by a bunch of peasants and a handful of wilderlords. Surely they have neither the numbers nor the organization to do so much damage. So they, like your own folk, turn to magic to make up the difference, he replied, smiling serenely, and they have planned for an extended engagement. The war party that attacked your huts was a mere test of their power, not intended as invasion, as much a survey of their strengths. Our cousins have been planning this for a long, long time by either of your race's reckoning, Spellmonger, since long before you were born. They have hollowed out breeding pits in their warrens, and they have built huge smithies deep underground in the ruins of the Dradrian's old realms to prepare for it. Their numbers are once again high, though crowded, and they are led by a war leader long dead. Now that took me aback. He proceeded to tell me a long tale about how my ancestors, after they had conquered the Majocracy, had turned their eyes west. He was lecturing me about my own history, in other words. Back then, I knew, the present-day duchies of Castal and Alsha were settled by humans only along the coasts, mostly by Cormeran pirates-turned-sea-lords, imperial merchants and nobles, and retired veterans from the Majocracy granted their legacies as rich inland farms, who became coastlords, before King Kamaklavan granted them to his two youngest sons. The Majocracy had even signed a treaty or something with the Alka'alon and the Govani, promising not to cross into those lands north of the Scarred Lands and other natural defences. Back then, the interior was dominated by the Alon races, notably the Govani and the Riverfolk, though the Alka'alon were also present in small numbers in remote cities, refuges, or simply wandering parties on extended nature walks. The human settlements in the interior were small at first, expansions of the old Majocracy's coastland outposts on the frontier. Mostly the Ark Magi kept their promises. But then my ancestors had to ride down from the northeast and dash all of those plans. Kamaklavan's descendants were content with their rich strips of land and stately plantations for only a generation or so, before they tore up the Majocracy's ancient treaty and began claiming whatever lands their barbaric knights could hold against the non-humans. Once we came north and west of Gilmora, say, they didn't like us much as neighbors anymore. The Govani were pushed out. They fled from the fertile lands we sought for ourselves. Year by year we forced them back, taking over their richest lands and hunting the non-humans like animals. By the time of the first of the Goblin Wars, they had only a few organized settlements in the Minden range of mountains, Bovol Valley being one. That slow push into Gilmora and beyond brought us humans closer and closer to the Gurvani's most sacred lands, eventually struggling against the non-humans in what is often known unofficially but popularly as the Goblin Wars. This wasn't a real war, more a sustained series of conflicts, skirmishes, raids and battles between the Alshari Wilderlords and the tribal Gurvani. What we saw as legitimate expansion into the iron and timber-rich lands beyond Gilmora was to the goblins a tragedy that continuously uprooted the Govani and pushed them deeper into the mountains. The Aronin explained that from here, the Govani's last desperate counterattack, a mere 150 years ago, had been organized under two charismatic Govani brothers, a mighty war leader named Grogora, and an inspirational shaman named Sherul. Grogora was a great chieftain who united the disparate Govani tribes under his kingship, while Sherul tapped into the forces of Irianite with his sect of shamans and unleashed horrible plagues and magical beasts on humankind to stem the tide of advance. They were successful for a few years. Alshar was suffering an interregnum and dynastic dispute at the time, thanks to our disorganization and their increasing numbers. Then the new Duke of Alshar came to power and decided to end the Govani harassment of his northernmost territories for good. He wasn't necessarily bloodthirsty. From what I recall, Alshar needed the great forests of the Wilderlands for the timber to construct yet another great fleet. The Duke sent 10,000 heavy cavalry north beyond Gilmora, when the smouldering conflict with Castal finally permitted him to. He rewarded the men with ample holdings taken from their conquest, and it gave him something to distract the great nobles in the rich coastal regions from the wide trail of bodies, some of them family, he'd left behind him on his way to the throne. That much I remembered from history. The Govani, the Aronin assured me, were unable to stand against the aggression of armored Nasari cavalry. From then on they lost every major encounter, their tribal infantry and small bows being ineffectual against the new Wilderlords. They gathered their forces for one final push, and about 200 years ago they came streaming forth from the Sacred Valley and their other warrens to strike at the few major strongholds of Alshar. They got their furry little asses handed to them. It was a nasty, brutal war, with quarter neither asked nor given. The nocturnal Gervani made every night a hell of screams and flames, and every day the gleaming steel and thundering horses of the knights hunted down the goblins and destroyed them utterly when they found them. Shaman and war mage strove for the upper hand in the arcane sphere, and caught many innocents on both sides in the crossfire. Few pitched battles fought, and when they were in our favor. Mostly, the wars were a series of bloody skirmishes against isolated settlements on both sides. It all came to a head at the Battle of Green River, 100 miles northwest of Varun, when the main Gervani army crossed the ford at dusk, using magic, Gervani hate water, and ambushed the Duke of Alshar's encampment. If it hadn't been for the timely arrival of fresh Gilmoran cavalry, history might have made a different turn. As it was, Grogoror was slain, and the surviving remnant of his forces were driven back up into the hills. In the weeks afterward, the ducal armies defeated the isolated pockets of Gervani resistance in their mountain strongholds again and again. Eventually, through subterfuge, say the histories, or treachery, implied the Aronin, the Duke of Alshar's men tracked the remnants of the Gervani force to their sacred valley, captured and beheaded the surviving brother, the shaman, Sherul, and had his head publicly placed on a pike, and paraded around for the prisoners to see in the style of the Alshari coastlords, who love to do that sort of thing to their enemies. The Gervani were aggrieved by such a disrespectful display, it was said. The head was stolen away that night by his disciples, who vowed revenge, but the war was effectively over. A few small bands continued to resist the Wilderlords, but most of the Gervani fled the resistance broken. The rest of the conflict was really just mopping up, ushering in an era of relative peace for the wild country. For the humans, that is. The Sacred Valley was given in fief to Sire Kusi's family, House Brandmount, on the condition that they keep it clear of all Gervani. The defeated Gervani of the Vale put up little resistance, and retreated again into the higher mountains of the Minden Range and the lands beyond. The Aronin himself was here to see this, he reported. To him, it was as if it had happened a few years ago. I could see why they were so pissed at the treatment. Alshari coastlords have a reputation of playing nasty during war, since most of their ancestors were brutal Cormiran corsairs who enjoyed such displays over their enemies. The Gervani had pretty typical tribal ideas of respect and honor for your fallen enemies, which they saw as being violated in the treachery and execution of Sherul, especially if their ancestral culture hero was born here. Now the threat is even greater, the Aronin said in his calm, musical voice. The Gervani have been plotting and preparing for revenge for the last 200 years, since Sherul was slain. They have been biding their time in the mountain fastness, building up forces, making weaponry, and waiting. For us to get fat, dumb, and happy, I sighed. The raid on Minden Hall was just a test of our forces and their response. Indeed, the wise old Alcan said gravely, nor will they repeat the errors of their ancestors. They would not chance a raid like that, unless they could follow it with a more serious threat. The real attack will be orders of magnitude greater, and it will come on or before the new moon. Is that prophecy, Aronin? I asked, not knowing a proper form of address. Imperial magic and the bans forbid such spells for humans, but the tree folk didn't recognize our laws. Our cousins are not stupid, though they might be ignorant. The king of the tree folk continued patiently. They are determined to return to their previous dominion and drive you, Humani, as far from the Minden Range as possible. Here, take my hand, he said, suddenly offering his five slender, childlike fingers. He was doing more than being friendly, as I saw something like an apis of curious design form over his palm. I considered trying to create a similar apis, then decided that it might be seen as arrogant. The Aronin knew what he was doing. I took his hand. Flash. We were still seated across from each other, but the room had faded away around us. It was as if we were hovering in the air, several miles over the valley, and all of Beauval was spread out before us. I realized that we were in the other world, the land of dreams and nightmares, where serious magi do their hardest work. It took me several hours to prepare myself for such a trip, but the Aronin had brought us there as casually as I would have opened a bottle. Spellmonger, look at the numbers of our cousins. I looked. In the mountains all around me I could see the tiny sparks that indicated, apparently, knots of Govani. They were gathering on all sides of us, with denser clusters approaching the Moor Tower, Beauval Castle, and the fortress of Brandmount. Hundreds, maybe thousands. Such things are difficult to tell in the other world. But we would be hard-pressed to hold out against them, should they all attack at once, I realized, even with Great Beauval Castle as a fortification. Then I saw the hundreds more bands still waiting in the western mountains, and yet more on the way, and suddenly I felt great despair come over me. There were enough to easily overwhelm any defense we could put up, and probably enough to mount a credible invasion of Alshar. See the magics our cousins bring to bear against you. The scene changed slightly, and I witnessed the number of shaman that accompanied the warrior bands. In most there was a greenish glow that I concluded meant they bore shards of Irionite, similar to the one I had captured. That made me all the more despairing. There were hundreds. If they had even half the wit to use them, my little speck of witchstone would be of little avail. Then I noticed a huge green glow in the center of the greatest knot of warriors still left in the mountains, a glow that dwarfed the other sparks below us to near invisibility. Some titanic force was there to aid them. Not just a mere shaman, even a king among shaman. This was something else. Something so powerful that the mighty Aronin was concerned. I suddenly understood why the single Gervan shaman I slew looked so triumphant, even in death. He had that power on his side. The Govani were resurgent, and they were taking no chances. We are doomed, I moaned. Perhaps, agreed the Aronin. Perhaps not. Can you not help us? I pleaded. Nay. We shall not take up arms against our cousins, save in defense, nor shall we do so for them. Yet they pose a threat to my people as well as yours. The great glow you see is troublesome. A knot of magic that large has not been seen outside our realms since elder days. It is controlled by a strange intelligence that rebuffs me every time I try to go near it. I'm afraid that once our cousins are finished with you, they will war with us out of spite. Don't count us out yet, I countered, a little irritated at his assumption. We beat them once. We can do so again. Brave words, spellmonger, he said into my mind. You shall need such bravery to face the horde that descends upon you. But even at the height of the Magocracy, when the greatest Archmage ruled with the Emerald Staff and the Crown of Souls, the Imperium did not have the might to withstand this power. What is it? I asked, mystified. It is abhorrence, what they have done. An abomination. Our cousins are not evil themselves, but some great force, full of hate and malice, has possessed them and promised them glory and power. I know not how they fashioned it so, but the power there, he said, indicating the bright spot on the horizon, is greater than any since the fall of our greatest cities. It is unlikely that even the remaining realms of the Alka-Alon can withstand it.
Then what can we do?
I asked gloomily. The Aronin seemed to know his stuff, and if he was worried, I felt utterly doomed. This node of malevolence is well protected now. It lies buried in the heart of the mountains, within a maze of warrens. To strike at it now would be futile. If it can be drawn out, however, then perhaps it can be destroyed. But to do so, you must be cunning and stubborn in your defense, so that only the node could break you. It may well cost you your life and destroy the valley, but it may ultimately save your people from enslavement and death. You want me to stand against that? With every fiber of your strength, he acknowledged. I was hoping for a little more in the way of guidance than that, I admitted. Aronin, I'm just a pretty fair spellmonger and a mediocre war mage. I have the respect of a few villagers and the friendship of one pipsqueak wilderlord at my disposal, not armies and professional war magi. How can I possibly make a stand here?
You do not give yourself enough credit, spellmonger.
Yes,
you are young, even by the count of your own race. But you are vital. Yes, you have few forces to set against our cousins, but you shall soon have more. This I have foreseen. You are trained in the arts of war and magic, and you have little experience. But you shall strive, spellmonger, with our help and the help of others. Fate puts us where we are needed. Even your crude, ignorant race can see that. That is why we help you thus. I cannot foresee if you will be successful, but I know that you will try, and if nothing else, lend hope and inspiration to your folk. If you can last long enough to draw out this abomination, then other forces may be brought to bear on it.
That sounds good in theory, Aronin, but where is this help you are speaking of? Am I just supposed to pull an army out of my ass? Am I going to find the staff of the Archmage under my bed? Will I be able to pick up Defender of Empires at a junk shop? I was starting to get a little peeved. I came up here looking for advice. What I got was a tale of woe and doom and a lecture on public service and a lot of mystical shit about me saving the duchies. The Aronin had all but said defending the valley was pointless, but he was encouraging me to do so in the face of overwhelming odds. Sure, I'd give it my best shot if I absolutely had to, but after seeing the forces arrayed against us, I would just as soon go become a swineherd on the other side of Upper Vor and leave all this behind me. I said as much. I braced myself for his fury. No one speaks to an Alka-Alon that way, much less the king of the local grove. Not without consequences. Luckily, the Aronin had a sense of humor. He smiled pleasantly, and suddenly we were back in that untidy little room.
The assistance I spoke of is here. First, let me see the stone you took from the shaman.
I handed it over with no witty sarcasm. He took it in his hands, closed his eyes, and began rubbing it back and forth between his palms.
It is part of a much larger piece, a piece that commands it. It was foolish of you to attempt to use it. The one which controls the larger piece instantly knew your thoughts by doing so, had he been paying any attention to it. Here in Nemadia, it is shielded from even that connection, and I can easily break it.
He sat there, rubbing it for a while, and all around him powerful forces came into play. It was intimidating.
It was an awful lot like standing right next to someone who was performing an elegant and graceful dance while you stare down at the hobnailed boots on your two left feet. He was directing titanic forces without breaking a sweat, and it was making me feel pretty inadequate. Finally, he stopped and presented the stone back to me, glowing in the center of his palm. It was no longer rough and uneven, but had become a smooth sphere, a marble of vivid, translucent green almost an inch wide. I reached out my hand to take it when he grasped my hand again, pressing the marble of pure power between our two palms. I felt a surge of energy like a lightning strike, and suddenly, I saw everything, clearly. I had access to more power now than I ever had. The Archmagi of old couldn't have wielded forces this great, I felt. My every thought was magnified tenfold, a hundredfold, and compared to before, when I had to struggle to build up enough power to fill one measly kaba, now I could fill 100 and not tire. But I also began to understand just what we were up against. From our cloud-top view, I had seen hundreds of shaman with these things, and from what the Aronin had said, they were all connected, like some giant Apis array, to the severely potent central force deep in the heart of the Minden Range. Trig and Brigga, help us all.
You are now connected with the stone at your very core, at your Shen, he said,
using the old imperial term for your magical soul, the center of your being, your consciousness.
This stone will now aid you, for not only have I introduced you to its power, but I have left my own mark upon it. Should this stone be placed in contact with one of the lesser stones you face for a time, then at your will the connection to the center will be broken, and the stone will henceforth be yours to command.
Its will? I asked, dumbfounded.
Use this gift wisely, spellmonger, for it is not given lightly. You also may communicate with me through this stone, but at great need only. The rest is up to you.
My thanks, my lord. It is not an army, but it will be a good place to start. I admitted. I was drunk with power. How could any Govani shaman stand against me?
Lastly, you spoke of mighty weapons. While I will not lend you my spear, for that is not our way, should you come to the halls of the Kashak Alon, show them this, and they will aid you as they might.
Right. The Kashak, I said, dazedly staring at the little globe that shone in my palm. This, too, seemed to amuse the Aronin.
The feeling you have will pass in a few days, spellmonger, and you will soon grow used to wielding this kind of power. I have searched your Shen, and I believe that your body and your spirit are strong enough to bear this burden.
Maybe he was right. It seemed foolish and vain to even contemplate such a thing, but maybe I was just the kind of crazy Humani mage who could orchestrate a resistance to this gathering storm. I finally looked up at the Aronin and feebly tried to grin. I shall do my best, Aronin, for my people and for myself. Even should I fall, they will remember the name of Minilan the Spellmonger to frighten their pups with at night.
Our cousins are nocturnal,
Aronin reminded me gently.
Oh, yeah.
Chapter 5. Preparing for Siege. 3 days later found me back in the southern part of the valley, preparing for another long journey. We had left the tree folk in the evening, after being feted in grand style. Zagor renewed a number of acquaintances among them, and Tyndall's eyes nearly fell out of his head as he witnessed wonders and beauties that he had never imagined in his previous life as a stable boy. I think the lad would have stayed there forever, just to be close to Amaras. I can't say I blame him. We stopped in Malin only long enough to warn the townsfolk to take whatever they could to the stronghold at Brandmount.
There had been sightings of Gavanni among the ridges, but no attacks this far north yet. They were wary, but the prospect of raids was enough to spur them into action, particularly with Zagor's respected opinion added to mine. Then we rode back by the old castle, a square, squat tower surrounded by a thick stone wall that seemed woefully inadequate, suddenly, to drop off Zagor and inspect the preparations for siege. The place was already abuzz with activity, as cows, horses, and chickens were loaded into the inner recesses of that mouldy pile of rocks, and militias drilled inside the barbican. Don't mistake me. Brandmount was a perfectly adequate fortification, and kept in good repair by Sir Remelan, the vigorous younger brother of Sire Cussy, but next to the recently completed Beauval Castle, it seemed paltry. Hopefully it would be enough to withstand the coming assaults. From what the Aronin had shown me, I had my doubts. It was designed to protect the people of Malin, Brandmount Village, the hamlet of Roby, and the outlying farmsteads, and I was pleased to see the castellan in charge of provisions had not been neglectful of stocking up on staples during peacetime, as they often did. I left Zagor in charge of the magical protection, and he promised he would draft the Bolliek sisters, two self-taught witches in Roby, to assist. From Brandmount, we rode back through Himmer's town and witnessed a similar buzz on a larger scale. Garkescu's shop was closed already, I noticed, as was the Lakeside Inn. Commerce had been suspended and the cheeses, normally stored for sale to merchants, were being loaded into wains to be taken to the castle, as per Sir Kay's orders. We stopped in town only long enough to bake supper from a bakery, one of the clients I stole from Garkescu, actually. I used the secret handshake of the Baker's Guild to do it, too. Hooray for artisanal nepotism. They were feverishly turning much of their stored flour into hard tack for the castle, so I didn't bother them much. But with my newfound powers, I couldn't resist trying out a small spell that would conserve heat in the ovens, thereby using up much less precious firewood. We reached Beauval Castle by nightfall, and I could see that Sire Cussy was doing his damnedest to prepare. There were sentries crowded into the towers and along the battlements, and the inner bailey was, if anything, more crowded than Brandmount had been, even though it was almost three times as big. Sir Kay was busily directing each new arrival to their designated spot, storehouse or post. We turned our horses over to the stable boy, a friend of Tyndall's, I found out, and sought out the sire himself. We found him in the dungeon, the massive square central tower and place of last defense, in a chamber that served as a combination office and conference room. We could tell where he was without asking. The constant stream of messengers indicated his whereabouts. We waited patiently in line at the door until he saw us. He smiled, waved away the others, and invited us in. "So, Master Minelan, how fared your quest for knowledge?" he asked, smiling through a tired face. "As well as I could have expected, Lord, and perhaps even better. I now know when the foe will attack, and I know their approximate numbers." "Then you were a success, indeed. Do we have anything to fear in the next 3 days? That's the soonest that I'll be able to have the peoples of Minden's Hall and Himmus safely within my walls, and it will take another 2 days for those in Winnacar to join us. I've sent knights to escort them, lest they be attacked on the road. You should have no more direct attacks for at least a fortnight, my lord, and likely not until the new moon, 3 weeks hence," I answered confidently. "Alas, that does not stop their skirmishers from harassing our folk as they struggled to bring their worldly goods into safety. Their scouts spy on us even now, concealed among the peaks and ridges. We broke up one such attack on our way north." "There's nothing to be done about it, I'm afraid," Cussy sighed. "I've increased patrols along the roads and given what escorts I can spare. But 3 weeks will give us adequate time to lay in a larger supply of stores. As it is," he said, referring to a slate on the table in front of him, "the castellan reports that we have enough wheat, hardtack, barley, dried fishes, cheeses, beans, salt pork, dried beef and desiccated vegetables to keep everyone in the castle fed at full rations for 5 months. In addition, the herds that are being brought in could feed us for an additional 3 months. The cisterns are full and the well is deep. That is where we stand now. With this extra time, we might be able to stretch it for 10 months or longer.
Excellent, sire, I said, knowing we couldn't hope to last that long. I didn't mention that yet. No need to plunge the man into despair when he was feeling so optimistic. And how are we disposed for fighting men?
Sire Kusi sighed more heavily.
Alas, we are not a warlike country, Master Spellmonger. I have 18 mounted knights, another dozen squires, and maybe 2 dozen sergeants and 100 trained men-at-arms. With the militias called in, we can arm another 600 or 700, mostly bowmen, 800 fighting men to man the walls, and every one of them precious.
I almost didn't have the heart to tell him about the number of Gavani arrayed against him. I tried to break the news as gently as possible, pointing out that his gentlemen were the match for any 3 goblins. But he was no fool. He sagged when I hinted at the numbers he was facing, that we were facing. Looking grim and worn, he stood defiantly and declared, "They will take this valley only after standing over my bleached bones and a mighty heap of their own corpses."
"Well spoken, sire," I said with an enthusiasm I didn't feel. "But we are not lost yet. Apart from the intelligence which I gathered from the tree folk, they lent me magical aid which might turn the tide of battle." I didn't elaborate, because the technical details would be lost on this warrior, as well as raising his hopes falsely. Never tell a client too much information. It makes them uneasy. But we need more men to man the towers, that much is true. What of aid from Gans, or Presson, or the Count? Has word been sent to Duke Lenguin?
Word reached both baronies only yesterday. If our messengers were not taken on the road, I have had no response yet, and I fear that both barons will be more concerned with protecting their own domains than sending assistance to us, a poor mountain relation. That is what I would do, after all. And while I dispatched a messenger to the summer capital, he has already departed from Verone for the winter. He will not arrive at the southern capital for at least another week. Mayhap a messenger could overtake him on the road, but if Trigg's grace be with us, it would be months before any help could be sent.
If, then, the Oshari dukes had a history of ignoring the Wilderlands portion of their realm, unless they needed more timber and iron for their precious fleets, we could not wait that long. We needed more fighting men, and we needed them now.
Then we must secure more warriors another way. My lord, as you know, I am recently discharged from the ducal army of Castal. There and after, in my travels as a war mage, I became acquainted with a number of mercenaries. While I realize that you are not a wealthy man, compared to some lords, still there must be enough in the treasuries to hire a few score warriors to buttress your defense. Am I mistaken?
Nay, save that you perhaps underestimate the pass my house holds. When the first Lord Brandmount came to this valley, he captured much in the way of treasure from the goblins. It was still substantial, even after we paid our lawful tribute to our liege. Have you not wondered why a land this small could afford a castle fit for a barony, much less 2 lesser fortresses? We did not do so by selling Bovary cheese, I assure you.
Yes, mercenaries would be most welcome, but the closest city in which you might be able to hire them is Tudri, some 5 days' journey by horse. Deploying them would take much longer, unless your magic can speed them along.
My lord, I propose just that. I shall travel to Tudri and arrange for as many companies as I can to come to our aid, and spread the word that you are hiring more. Many of the free companies lack for work since the end of the Phyresian campaign, and they despise ordinary garrison duty. It should not take much to convince them to ride here for the promise of good pay and a worthy foe. I wouldn't, of course, elaborate on just exactly what odds they faced. Many had fought goblins before, and would see the duty as pleasant exercise, not a serious fight for their lives.
Fools.
Kusi shrugged. I have no objection, Spellmonger, provided that you oversee the defensive magic preparations your, colleague, Garkescu, has been working on before you leave. You will find him in the West Tower, which I have assigned my magical corps.
He said it with a thin smile that let me know what he thought of the other spellmonger in his realm. "As you wish, sire," I said, returning the grin with a slight bow. I took my leave then, as a long line of messengers and soldiers on errands had piled up behind me. My trip downriver to the academy was an exciting, grand adventure that took 2 weeks. In retrospect, it was no different than any other river trip I've taken. But when you are 13, have never been more than 5 miles from your birthplace, and journeying on your own such a trip is an adventure by default. I saw stevedores and pullmen, merchants and river pirates, and met strange, exotic people who were not all that different from the folk in Tulri. I did see a village of river folk, my first glimpse of non-humans, but we passed by their little settlement without stopping. One of the crew taught me the finer points of dice, and another introduced me to Cormyran wine. I proved lucky enough at the former to subsidize the latter without dipping over much into my purse. I arrived at the river port near Inarion, a much more worldly man, ready to meet my schoolmates and embark on my education. When I first arrived at the academy, a mix of high imperial and post-conquest imperial revival architecture, I learned later, I could see the beautiful spires and hulking mass of the central building over the tops of the townhouses and shops by the gate, and I was suitably awed. I was much less awed by it a week later. The academy, pretty from a distance, was a dump. 600 years old and poorly maintained, the spires around the top were roped off due to severe structural failure. Apparently, the spells originally used to allow their graceful slopes to defy gravity were long lost, and not much effort had been put into rediscovering them. Most of the buildings originated in imperial times, which means that they were sadly neglected and in need of repair. The main hall on the first floor was built to impress, and its shabby opulence remained stunning, despite the years. The classrooms on the second and third floors of the building were less impressive, but completely functional, while the journeyman labs on the fourth floor were almost as dangerous as the decorative spires. The masters, of course, had much better facilities, usually in outbuildings built more recently. Inarion Academy was founded almost 1,000 years ago as an adjunct campus to the more prestigious Godinal Academy in Cormyr. Godinal was destroyed in the Mage Wars, before the late Magocracy was established, so Inarion is technically the second oldest academy in the duchies, after Alla, and the most prestigious in the western duchies. It sits within its own section of the city wall, and has been defended 4 times in its history. Inarion Academy is a little city within itself, as self-contained as any castle, complete with its own attendant village, known as Tower Town. The academy holds about 300 students at any one time, with another 100 visiting scholars or guest instructors from other academies or magical firms. Almost every student there was of noble birth. I don't think I really appreciated that until I showed up at the registrar's office, barefoot and dirty from the trip, and was told with a scowl that the kitchens were in the rear. I tried to explain myself 3 times, and finally had to produce my letter of acceptance, before I was firmly escorted to my quarters by the registrar herself. I was assigned to the South Tower, where, I found out later, all the low-status students were housed. Children of merchants, burghers, country knights, and successful farmers. Plus a few students from the petty nobility. Too poor to blend well with the Imperials in the West Tower, or the High Lords in the North Tower were housed there. The East Tower was the faculty quarters. We were the social dregs, which made the tyranny of the few noble-born students in South that much harder to bear. Of course, the South Tower was the least maintained. It was rumored that the whole purpose of putting us in such decrepit quarters was to encourage us to learn those spells that contributed to comfort, and I can't say with certainty that the rumors were untrue. I know I studied my ass off to learn how to do heating and anti-vermin spells and the like. To be fair, we weren't treated that much differently than the other students. The instructors didn't really care who your sire was. They cared how well you did in their courses. But our clothes were never as splendid as the Narasi lords, or as silken as the imperial students, and we had no servants of our own. The entire tower, from first form to fifth, depended on the good graces of a few old groundskeepers, three wrinkled maids and a single cook. We ended up doing a lot of the cleaning and chores ourselves. I was placed in a third-floor suite with Dexterdot, Dex, to his pals, of Haring, the sandy-haired son of a poor knight, and Timian of Leicester, the son of a wheat merchant. For the next 4 years, they would be my best friends and confidants. Both had similar initiatory experiences as I, and both had been sent to the same extra remedial tutors as I was. These were mostly lessons in reading, writing, elementary math, natural history, and basic rules of etiquette. That is, how to behave like nobility and not like peasants. Since the bans required those with talent to give up their noble titles and legacies, we were all legally commoners, but that did little to protect us actual commoners. A few of the noble boys started to literally lord it over us about these classes, but my mates and I took this guff for only a few weeks before we got fed up with it and staged a peasant revolt of sorts, which turned quickly into a spectacular brawl. After that, we had their respect, if not their friendship, and were allowed to proceed with our studies in relative peace. Magi, at least according to the Academy, were to be accorded the respect of minor nobility, regardless of birth status or station. The nobles and the ducal houses, I have noticed, don't always adhere to this rule. Regardless, as most of our clients would eventually be nobles of one stripe or another, our professional survival depended upon knowing the rules of courts of all sizes. These extra tutoring sessions were in addition to the regular courses. They started in heavy, with magical theory and symbolic systems, and before I had been there a week, my head buzzed nightly with the arcane symbols of my new craft. That didn't leave much time for trouble, much to my dismay. When I wasn't slogging through some dusty text in my loft, I was in the kitchen, helping the cook with the baking for an extra 3 coppers a week. All of the boys were required to help with the maintenance, cleaning and upkeep of the academy grounds, which provoked much grumbling from the former nobility. But a few of us were good enough at what we did to get paid for it. The first time I made rolls for the cook, she had me put on the pay ledger. Dad was proud of that. Those first few years at the academy were a long, pleasant, hazy smear in my life, although at the time they seemed almost hellish. I attacked my lessons with glee, pushing ahead beyond my classmates at every opportunity. I had a strong talent and a quick mind, and I mastered the basic lessons easily. I also demonstrated a facility for the obtuse subject of thaumaturgy, the science of magic, and scored top marks in my class. This got me enough attention from the journeymen who instructed us that I was selected for special tutoring that first year. Most importantly, to my eyes, I was introduced to the magic of the written word, and then turned loose on some of the best libraries in the duchy. I discovered that I loved reading, after mastering the art, and spent as much time as I could in the academy's dusty libraries. I learned to master my mind and force the elements of nature to do my bidding. I was guided down the intellectual path trod by generations of students before me, back to Lost, Perwin, and the first Archmage. History, poetry, and thaumaturgic texts were havens for me. I actually went home between my third and fourth years for my youngest sister's wedding. Ura had finally talked a stuttering one of Dad's apprentices into marrying her, and I wanted to surprise everyone. I had made a little money doing spells on the side, completely against academy rules, but those rules were often overlooked, and I managed to secure transport on a river barge, hauling iron ingots up the Burin to Talri and points north. It was a complete surprise to my family, of course. My dad didn't even recognize me when I first came into the shop, and my reunion celebration nearly overshadowed my sister's nuptials, to the point that I earned several evil stares from her. This was her celebration. It was my first time meeting my nieces and nephews, though, and I wasn't about to fade into the woodwork until I had a chance to ooh and ah over them. I saw several of my childhood friends, most of whom were farming or running their father's shops. I spent some important time with my very proud parents, who wanted to hear about everything I was doing at the mysterious academy. After the wedding, I caught up with Master Tilo, who looked even more wizened than the last time I saw him. He was almost as proud of me as my parents, and he even allowed me to show him a thing or two in the way of technical advances on some minor spells. He had another apprentice now, and I was put in the uncomfortable position of being held up as a good example of a good mage. I wasn't used to being a role model. I still am not. But the acknowledgement was good for my ego. But something troubled me that entire trip. I just didn't fit in Tulri anymore. My sister's husbands had the shop well in hand. Dad rarely worked at anything but overseeing the most demanding of bakes, and Mama was deeply involved in her grandchildren. I was an exciting curiosity to them, but not much more. Oh, they still loved me, without a doubt, but I was a stranger to them after just a few years. I suppose that after spending all that time being homesick at the academy, that I expected the clouds to part, and Trigg and Brigga and a host of gods to welcome me back home in triumph. Instead, I stood in the bakery and tried not to get in the way, while my family worked. In an effort to console myself, Pity, I went by Hedy's cottage. Remember the miller's daughter? To visit. Her husband, a prosperous farmer, was in the fields, of course, but she introduced me to her 2-year-old and let me pat the tummy in which her second kid was growing. It was the same old Hedy, though, wild at heart. With a wicked gleam in her eyes, she pointed out that, as there was no way she could get pregnant at the moment, that there was no obstacle to us reliving old times. I was in a weakened condition and didn't have the courage to turn her down. We did it on her kitchen table while the baby was asleep. While she was just as enthusiastic as I remember, and far more skilled, marriage had been good to her, I knew that this was merely an illicit thrill for her, not a heartfelt homecoming. I left her home feeling even more out of place than when I arrived. I had to face a very depressing reality. Tulri was just not really my home any longer. Garkescu had, indeed, taken over the second and most comfortable level of the West Tower for his own use and that of his apprentices. He had 3, all touched by talent and somewhat knowledgeable in the theories of magic under his tutelage, but none of them the equal of Tyndall. The boy had learned more in 6 months of study with me than they had learned after years with Garki. Unfortunately, they tended to make up for their lack of skill by parroting their master's arrogant attitudes and mannerisms, which made the whole second floor unbearably unpleasant. Garkescu had managed to move a fair amount of his equipment and much of his overstuffed furnishings into the quarters from his shop. The West Tower was inside the inner barbican and attached to the main dungeon by a series of buttresses and bridges, which made it unnecessary for defense until the outer bailey had been penetrated. It was as drafty and cold as any other place in the castle, but I noticed, as I climbed the stairs, that Garkescu had an insulation spell going to supplement the brazier burning in the center of the room. That could only mean that my floor, above, which should normally benefit from the heat from his fire, would be ice cold. The 2 older apprentices were unpacking crates moved from Himmer's town, and looked at me with barely concealed sneers when I walked in. Garkescu himself was overseeing the 3rd young apprentice, who was unpacking his master's bedding. He still wore that colourful robe and ridiculous-looking hat. "Master Garkescu, it is good to see you settling in," I said, a friendly tone in my voice that belied the expression in my eyes. The bastard was enjoying more comfort in here than the peasants who camped in the outer bailey could dream of. Garkescu looked up, his eyes growing wide when he saw who it was. Then they narrowed.
"Master Menelan, good of you to join us.
I took the liberty of choosing these accommodations in your absence, due to the larger size of my party. I trust you and your apprentice will have no difficulty with the next level up. I figured that a man of action such as yourself would prefer a vantage point where he could oversee the field." It was a thinly veiled challenge, meaning, "I dare you to try to move me out of my quarters." Had I more time and less patience, I might have tried. But he was right. The 3rd level would be better for me and Tyndall, as I would have access to the uppermost battlement, and therefore would be able to see farther at my convenience. It also made for a better position for launching defensive spells. magic or artillery, high ground is usually more defensible. I still remember how effective such a position had been when Oral Pratt had defended the citadel of Faris. Absolutely correct, Master Garkescu. In fact, I will have my apprentice bring my things up tonight. But I wanted to steal a moment of your time to discuss the overall defense strategy. He gave me a sour look, but motioned me over to a table he had fetched from his reception area. Cleared of the useless clutter, it seemed fairly serviceable, and I was surprised to see an accurate map of the castle and the surrounding lands already laid out upon it. At various places, Garkescu had inscribed symbols for spells he was apparently planning. I glanced at them and was mildly impressed. It was by no means complete, but it did have some clever essentials at more or less the right place. Just because I didn't like the man didn't mean he was incompetent. We went over what he had done, and I suggested a few more. Things like preservative spells on the stores and cisterns, strength runes on the gates and portcullis, the sort of thing he could get his apprentices to do without difficulty. We managed to complete the conference without arguing, which I counted as a minor victory, and then I told him about my next trip. He was not happy.
"So you wish me to cast all of these spells on my own, then?" he asked sarcastically.
"None of them seem too difficult between you and your apprentices. If you aren't up to the task, however, I can always send for Zagor, or..."
"I am quite capable, thank you," he said haughtily, "and if it makes the difference between victory and defeat, I will do all I can."
"I'm sure you will," I said smugly, and went upstairs to inspect our new quarters. Garkescu had done me no favours in selecting the lower chamber. The third level, a three-story section of tower with wooden floors and lofts, was perforated with arrow slits. While there were wooden shutters on them, the sheer number made the entire chamber as draughty as a bell tower. Still, it was more than enough room for Tyndall and me to work in, and I knew I could rely on the boy's ingenuity to make it as comfortable as possible in my absence. I made a few mental notes of items I would want from the shop in Minden's Hall, and others that would have to be purchased in Tudri. Then I went to the roof. Garkescu was correct. From the peak, I could see all around the castle, save the spot just beyond the east tower, which was the same height as the one I was on. I had no problems with the quality of the fortification. Indeed, it was among the better ones I had seen on my travels through the Wilderlands, where rough towers of ashlar and rough stone walls were the rule. Most baronial castles in the Riverlands were ancient things, whose stones were held together by 200-year-old mortar, or they were the remains of imperial buildings that had been added to, not really designed for defense, but pressed into service by need, and kept because of the expense of building proper defenses. Beauval Castle, though, was almost brand new, compared to the castles of Castal and Alshar that I was familiar with. Begun by Cusi's father at the start of his reign, the fortress had taken 20 years to complete, and had employed hundreds of local labourers and dozens of imported masons, carpenters, and other craftsmen. Cut out of native grey basalt from the quarry north of Minden's Hall, the walls and towers of the structure were well designed and resolutely strong. It was also roomy, about 3 times as large as the population of the valley warranted. House Brandmount was foresightful enough to know that their lands would prosper. They built large, in anticipation of a larger population, or a goblin invasion. The entire castle was surrounded by a 20-foot-wide ditch, with a berm of earth 10 feet tall on the inside edge. A 12-foot-thick stone barbican, surmounted by an impressive battlement, protected the castle should the ditch be overrun. The outer wall was punctuated with 9 small round towers, spaced 50 feet apart or so, as well as a large stone gatehouse to the north and a double-sized round tower at the southern point. This last feature was a miniature fortress in its own right, including the siege engines ensconced in the top of the structure and the separate well and stores at its base. The outer bailey was separated from the inner by a curtain wall 6 feet thick. This made the outer bailey an ideal killing zone, should the gate be overwhelmed. Until that happened, it was also the main residence of the peasantry who took refuge here, and their herds. A makeshift corral had been set up near the stables in the outer bailey. It was filled to overflowing with pigs, sheep, and a truly astounding number of cattle. The roadway between the main gate and the inner bailey had been kept clear, as had a path to the stables, but every other square foot of space was being used for tents, wagons, dogs, cats, livestock, laundry, children, and the like. The only other clear space was one in the centre of the largest grouping of shelters on the larger eastern side of the bailey, where refugees from Himmis had gathered. The central clearing was being used as a public gathering space and drill field for the militia. It was interesting. Not only had Himmis congregated together, the folk of Minden's Hall had clumped near the main gate on the western side, and the few people who had made the trip from the tiny hamlet of Winnaker had created a kind of village in exile along the curtain wall near the stables. The inner bailey was less crowded, as it was reserved for exclusively military personnel. That made it far, far more roomy than I would have preferred. In a siege, Wisdom said, one should have one fighting man for every 5 civilian non-combatants. Despite Sire Kusi's estimates, I could see the numbers for myself from my tower perch. With the militias and the few professional soldiers, there were about 200 men-at-arms, and many that were not that well-armed, available in the inner bailey, another 100 or so in the keep, and yet another 100 camped in the towers around the wall. Around 50 had packed themselves into the gatehouses and other outbuildings. Even if one considered another 100 out on escort duty and errands, that was several 100 shy of the 800 Kusi had estimated. That wasn't good. It took a minimum of 40 men to patrol the walls and man the various essential fortifications, but that was far from ideal. Right now, the civilians outnumbered the fighters 8-1, not counting the children. There was a recruiting effort going on among the people, and about 20 men a day were pressed into service. But it was clear that there were limits to what these peace-loving farmers could do. We would need several 100 more trained and equipped men if we wanted to hold out for more than a few months. Our tower was one of 2 that straddled the wall between the baileys. They were largely empty of people, except for us, and used for storage, but they could accommodate a few 100 more. The first level of each was 2 stories high, stacked with firewood, cowhides, arrows, bolts of homespun cloth, sack after sack of wheat, and barrel upon barrel of salted meat and other consumables. And cheese. Lots of cheese. Each was topped by a small wooden observation tower, perfect for us wizardly types who enjoyed a view. I felt safe here, and it was hard to imagine anyone able to break through that much stone. But the tall stone towers and thick walls were only as strong as the men who defended them, and in that we were sorely lacking. In the centre of the inner bailey was the donjon, a huge 5-storey square block of stone that was the castle's ultimate defence. Should all else fail, the donjon could hold more than 500 for quite a while, even against superior forces. Attached to the donjon in the south were 2 more blocky towers that rose above the rest of the castle and provided an excellent vantage point for directing forces in a siege. That was where Sire Kusi would be when the time came. It was secure for the moment, or the closest thing to security that we could hope for under the circumstances. I liked the vantage point up there. It would do, I decided. I could peg a goblin outside of the walls from here with bow or war staff. A real magical core could have held this castle from nearly any force, indefinitely. But we were poorer in arcane measures than we were in armored knights. Even with my shiny new stone as a reservoir, it was just Garkescu, me, and our half-trained apprentices against around 100,000 savage goblins, as well as potentially hundreds of shamans with their own witch stones. As sieges went, it was starting to sound like the beginning of a bad joke. But that problem, at least, I might be able to do something about. I knew people who owed me favours, or wouldn't mind me owing them favours, and I now had a currency beyond mere gold to offer. That evening I decided to try to gain some unexpected allies by magic. I made myself comfortable in the centre of the roof, seated on a cask of arrows, and began a complex spell that I just had not the strength to attempt before. It was time to talk to Pentandra. My 4th and 5th years at the academy flew by, and every year my techniques and understanding of the magical arts improved. By the time I was ready to produce journeyman-level work, I felt as cocky and adept as any old archmage. Many of my peers were already opting to take the exams and go into private practice, but I was enjoying the academic environment too much to try to make a living with what I'd learned so far. I submitted to the board a spell that I had worked on for months, and after rigorous review, it was accepted. They allowed me to partake in the journeyman trials. In a way, they prepare you for the trials from the day you arrive at the academy. Every scrap of magical lore you have ever learned comes to the fore, as you face one master after another, and they direct you to answer questions or perform spells. The trials last a week, and are held in a specially built building at the very edge of the academy's grounds. It was grueling. Only 6 out of 18 of us made it through the first time. When my name was called as one of the successful candidates, I was amazed. I'd thought I'd screwed it up royally. We successful new journeymen, or senior students, since we weren't technically apprenticed, were given 2 weeks off to celebrate, while our less adept peers gave it a second go. I spent my 2 weeks either stalking through the booksellers in town, looking for obscure texts, or chasing girls around the taverns of Tower Town. I also thought a lot about the big decision I had to make. In the 6th year at the academy,